Now I want to turn to your Old Testaments. The minor prophet Zephaniah is where we're going to take our lesson today. While you're doing that, I thought since I have the pulpit, I would just make note something of my cancer condition, just so that you'll know what's going on now. In September, when I went to the doctor, he noticed that the white blood cell count was starting to rise, and it has steadily increased from then till now. You may remember that I mentioned then, okay, I'm going to have to start taking the medicine again. And the thing about chronic leukemia is it mutates from time to time, so medicine I was using before wouldn't work anymore very well. And we're at another treatment, which is basically a pill that you take twice a day, and I'll take that until it stops working for me, and then we'll try something else. But that's where we are. The white blood cell count has gotten about six times what's normal, which is really not that big of a deal, but it has started affecting my health just a little bit. The lymph nodes are increasing slowly, and a little bit of fatigue, and so it's time to get started again, and I'm hopeful it'll work. So it's basically everything is as it is, as it has been. I've been tired a little bit over the last few months, but other than that, everything, I feel well, and I just wanted to ask you, please, to pray for the effectiveness of this particular drug. It just started on Friday, and not really any side effects. They say it's tolerated pretty well. There are side effects, but I've not felt any so far, and I'm happy for that. But I just wanted you to know about that, so that I wouldn't have to tell everybody singular. I could just tell you all at once. We're going to be talking this morning about God's disapproval, and that is how we might receive God's disapproval with regard to our particular actions, because that's a big portion of what the book of Zephaniah is about. Of course, you know that the prophet Zephaniah is referred to as a minor prophet, and he is not minor with regard to the importance of his message. Whenever you hear the word minor prophet, all that it has reference to is the length of the book. And so Zephaniah is not a very large book. And as a result of that, often the prophets were gathered together as a single collection because of the brevity of the various books. And then you have the major prophets like Isaiah and Jeremiah and Daniel, who are referred to as major prophets simply because their books of prophecy are longer as works. And so that's the difference. Zephaniah was an inspired preacher, just like all prophets were. Those who are true prophets are inspired of God. His short book was written during the reign of King Josiah. Now, those of you who are familiar with the reign of Josiah know that he was at the end of Judah's existence as a sovereign nation before the Babylonian Empire took them into captivity. And though Josiah was a good king and sought to do much that was good for the Lord, it seems like even as you examine the narrative of Josiah's reign, that the people were not really doing what they were told to do because they wanted to do it, just because they had to do it. And as soon as Josiah, his reign came to an end, everything fell apart again. But this was at the end of the existence of Judah as a sovereign nation, and God had had enough with the people of Israel. And as a result of that, God raised up the Babylonian king to come and to serve as his judgment, not only upon Judah, but upon the entirety of the world. And so there is reference in the book of Zephaniah to judgments that came upon other nations as well. And we may severally reference that as we get into our discussion. I want you to note, just as a way of introducing this, that the book of Zephaniah has a list of sins. Now, we are interested in that because in the New Testament we read various lists of sins that have been given by God. For example, in Romans chapter 1 and verse, verse 30. We'll start back with verse 29. They were filled with all unrighteousness, sexual immorality, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness. They were full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, evil-mindedness. They were whisperers, backbiters, haters of God, violent, proud, boasters, inventors of evil things, disobedient to parents, undiscerning, untrustworthy, unloving, unforgiving, and unmerciful. That's a pretty extensive list, isn't it? Now, it's not the only list that is given in Scripture, and in fact, it differs from the other list in certain particulars, although there are commonalities in those lists. But we have, for example, the lust of the flesh that is listed in Galatians 5, beginning in verse 19 of the text. Revelation chapter 21, I'll read verse 8 to make another note of a list. We are told here, the cowardly, the unbelieving, the abominable, the murderers, the sexually immoral, sorcerers, and idolaters, and all liars, it says, they shall have their part in the lake which burns with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. So here we see the condemnation of these individuals because of the sins that they committed. The same basic thing is found there in Romans chapter 1, that knowing the righteous judgment of God, they either practice these things or approve of those who practice them. And so that indicates again, as a result of their sinfulness or their approval of sinfulness, we are told, because God's righteous judgment is present, that not only will they do those things, consent to those who practice them, but because of it, they deserve death. And so we have this realization that we find not only in the Old Testament, but in the New, that God always deals with sin. We just have to acknowledge and recognize that. And we especially live in a society to where that's really not accepted in much of our society. The idea that we would have the temerity to condemn sin or to say that sin has consequences or that an individual might be actually lost eternally because of what he's doing, well, that's hate speech and that's judgmental. But no, what we're trying to do is warn about God's righteousness and the recognition that God always deals with sin. Now, he is merciful. He is certainly long-suffering, and he certainly loves us. And that is why he sent his Son to this earth to be our Redeemer. It was a great sacrifice when Jesus offered himself on the cross at Calvary. When he shed his blood, it offered us the opportunity to be reconciled to God. And as a result of that, our standing can be as God would have it to be, with him and enjoying his presence in eternity after this life is over. But the fact is, if individuals are unwilling to change their lives, God will judge them. We see evidence of this again and again and again throughout history. Now, do understand that, for example, the judgment of the Babylonians coming and taking the children of Judah into captivity, that was a lesser judgment than the final judgment. And we recognize that God and days of the Lord have happened throughout history. God has punished people for their sins. And so what this does is give us an opportunity to learn from what happened to the Jews and the nations round about at this particular time, so that we do not suffer the same fate ourselves. And so the first thing I want to do is simply go through the list of sins that are found here in Zephaniah. They're very different in some ways than the other lists that we have read, though there are, again, commonalities. And so we're going to start off by just noting eight of them that are listed in the book. The first one we want to note it is idolatry. And of course, we know that idolatry is something that God does not accept. Notice verses 4 and 5 of the first chapter of Zephaniah. We are told, I will stretch out my hand against Judah and against all the inhabitants of Jerusalem and cut off every trace of Baal from this place. So Baal was being worshipped in Jerusalem. The names of the idolatrous priests with the pagan priests, those who worship the host of heaven on the housetops, those who worship and swear oaths by the Lord, but who also swear by Milcom. Well, these are individuals who are guilty of idolatry. You recognize that that was the first of God's commandments to Israel, thou shalt have no other God before me. And as a part of that in Exodus 20 and verse 4, he says, You shall not make for yourself any graven image, a carved image, any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that's in the earth beneath, or that's in the water under the earth. You shall not bow to them or serve them. I am the Lord your God. I am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing mercy to thousands, to those who love me and those who keep my commandments. So we see that from Exodus chapter 20, indicating the very premise that we've established in our lesson this morning. But I do want to note, because of the sophistication of our day, where we all, I think, will acknowledge that graven images are superstitious, unlike maybe two centuries before. And in fact, we will, to a very great extent, make fun of the idea of Greek or Roman gods. I mean, there, for example, it's a big thing that happens in our culture today that comic books have basically taken hold of those Greek mythologies, and they put them up against Batman and Superman and Wonder Woman, and then you've got Zeus and you've got Hercules and all those kinds of things, and it's just a hodgepodge and a mishmash. Because we look at it and we say, that's just silly. But that's not all that idolatry is. Idolatry is much more than merely the worship of graven images. And if we think that we are too sophisticated to do that, I would hasten to say that almost everyone in our society is guilty of idolatry. There is a passage that is found in Colossians chapter 3 and verse 5, where the Apostle Paul wrote, to put to death our members which are on the earth, fornication, uncleanness, passion, evil desire, and covetousness, which is idolatry. So now we're talking a little different, aren't we? Not just talking about graven images, but we're talking about something that all of us can be touched with, and that is covetousness. We can covet what another has. It is an inordinate desire to gain something that does not belong to us. But why does Paul say it's covetousness? Now, I've explained this before, but it seems to me the simple explanation is that when you covet something, that what you are doing, because it is an inordinate desire, you want it enough to where you displace God with it. So people who covet money, they want money enough that they will set God aside for the purpose of getting what they want. Or it could be fame. It could be anything like that. But it could be a hobby. If an individual says, okay, I love God, but God's not going to come between me and going bird hunting on Sundays. It's just not going to happen because bird hunting is so important to me. And so they displace, can you imagine, the Almighty God of heaven. We make fun of the fact that, well, we've got this little idol that we've made ourselves and we set it up on our mantle, and then we worship that little piece of wood as a god. But then you have individuals who are basically worshiping bird hunting, putting bird hunting before God. You notice I didn't use golf this time. And they are guilty of idolatry as well. And so it's simple logic seen from Paul's admonition there. Anything which displaces God, is preeminent in our lives, becomes an idol to us, and we cannot let that happen. And so that's one of the things we want to know. A second thing is disobedience. But I want to emphasize disobedience here stemming from a lack of faith. Our faith is not strong enough, in other words. I want you to read from Zephaniah chapter 1 and verse 16, or verse 6, excuse me, concerning the inhabitants of Judah. They have turned back from following the Lord. They're not obeying the Lord. They have not sought the Lord. They have not inquired of Him. You remember, as a part of Josiah's reign, that it was necessary that the book of law be rediscovered, and they weren't doing things that they were supposed to do, and nobody cared to look. It was only Josiah who gave that command, and when he read the book of the law, and imagine what his mind as a righteous individual, how he must have felt when it came to his knowledge that he wasn't doing what God expected him to do and had not been doing. That generation had not been doing those things. The law had been lost, and they were ignorant because they were not searching for God. So the pagans in Rome are another example of this. In chapter 1 and verse 28, we already read the list, but why were those individuals so ungodly? Well, verse 28 of the text tells us that they did not like to retain God in their knowledge. I really feel like that's a societal thing here. I've made this point a number of times in my sermons that there are so many in the world today that are willing to accept Jesus as Christ, but are not willing to accept Jesus as Lord. And I want you to understand that. In other words, I am a believer in Jesus. I think that Christ has saved me. I love my Lord, but I've got something I want to do right now. And I'm too busy and my life is too complex, too interested in other things to obey God. It's amazing how often you see that. I see this often with regard to politics as an example, because you'll have individuals who will make appeals to the Almighty God of heaven, but then they use profanity, explicit profanity. And they'll talk about how wonderful an individual might be, but they do it with a glass in their hand, which is full of alcohol, and maybe they're already tipsy when they do it. And you see all of these kinds of things happening to where the lives that they live say, okay, I want to be with God. I want to be a part of that God thing. I don't want it to affect what I want to do in my life. It's an ability that people have to establish basically a disconnect. Yes, God. No, I'm not a fanatic about God at all. I want to be a part of His life, but I don't want my life to be governed by Him. And so they do not accept Him as Lord. And that happens so often in our day as well. I want you to notice in Zephaniah chapter 3 and verses 1 and 2, any nation, Jew or Gentile, it states here, woe to her who is rebellious and polluted. Specifically, Jerusalem, the oppressing city. She has not obeyed His voice. She has not received correction. She has not trusted in the Lord. She has not drawn near to her God. We need to recognize that God requires submission to His will as our Lord. Third one, compromise. You notice this list is a little bit different than the ones that we read in Romans chapter 1 or there in Revelation 21. Compromise. Notice in Zephaniah chapter 1, an interesting passage. It says, "It shall be in the day of the Lord's sacrifice, I will punish the princes and the king's children and all such as are clothed with foreign apparel." Now what difference does it make what you're wearing? You know, people ask that today as well. And I'm not saying here it's talking about anything immodest. What he's talking about here is the corrupting influence of those who are without. I want you to recognize this. It was the end thing to be like someone else. Don't we have that worship almost in our society today, whether it be some pop icon? You know, they got people who are fans of Taylor Swift and they call them the Swifties. And there, I saw just recently a couple of others. I don't remember what the names are. One was Lambs. I don't remember who that was associated with. And there was one other. But they're talking about all these individuals who their lives, basically, I want to be like that person. And I want to dress like that person. I want to act like that person. I'm going to listen only to that person's music. And that person is so important to me. And it doesn't matter that these may be immoral individuals or what they sing may be awful and ugly or whatever the case may be. It's this fandom. And it happens with pop stars. It happens with actors. It happens with politicians. It happens with athletes. Just anybody who's up there. Okay, I want to be a part of that. I want to be like that. And that's kind of what we're talking about. You remember when the Jews, early on in their history, they had been governed by a number of judges, Samuel being the last judge. And what did they ask of God? We want to be like the nations round about. Give us a king. We want to be like them. And so we're talking here about that kind of compromise. And as with the Jews, corrupted by the outside influence of other nations, we are to keep ourselves unsullied by corrupting influences around us. You know as well as I do that that can happen. 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 33, I like the New King James rendering of this. Don't be deceived. Evil company corrupts good habits. You know, that's an assertion. There's no proof that he gives there. There's no proof that is needed because the anecdotal evidence is overwhelming. Every one of us see it in our own lives, times that we or our loved ones have done things they ought not to do because of the people that they were hanging around. It's just a truth that is axiomatic. It's going to happen. If you allow yourself to be around individuals, to make them a central part of your life, you want them as your companions, you want them as your friends. As a result of that, you're going to be in trouble eventually because evil influences can corrupt you. We're told in James chapter 1 and verse 27, talking about pure, undefiled religion, it says, keep oneself unspotted from the world. Now, you wonder about that. Well, what do you mean, Stan? You can't be in the world? No, that's not what I'm saying at all. You have to work in the world. You got employees or you are an employee and there's worldliness there. You go to the grocery store and there is worldliness there. It's everywhere. You've got family. Worldly families for many of us. They don't hold to the same ideals that we hold. And the Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 5 very clearly establishes that you have to go into the world. In fact, we are we not, to be the light of the world. The city which cannot be set, or which is set on a hill which cannot be hid. That's what we are to be. But do we have to enjoy and embrace those individuals as being like us or individuals that we do what they do, or that it's important for us to be respected by them or to be involved in those situations? We are a peculiar people. We are to be different. We need to recognize that that is the case. Yes, you can be involved with someone who's not a Christian, but you better understand that you are to be the influence upon them. And every part of that relationship, and parents, I want you to understand this, every part of that relationship should be based upon that. You got to send your kids to school and they'll have school friends. But you have to preach to them and teach them and by example show them that you're not going to allow them or yourself to be influenced what without. What they need to do, I wouldn't say be standoffish, but it would be to say, I'm not like them and I don't want to be like them and I'm not going to be like them. Because that's not right. Service to God is most important. Righteousness is most important. And I'll tell you something. If you find someone that you really, really like, and it comes to the point where they aren't satisfied with you because of your faith, and they expect you in some way to change, or the situation becomes uncomfortable because they aren't comfortable around you because you're shining as a light in the world, you need to get away from that person. Because if you're not influencing them for good, chances are they're going to influence you for evil. It's a very real danger. And we look at the Israelites, those in Judah at this particular time, the Jews, and see that very thing was happening. They were being compromised. Now, the next thing I want to talk about is immorality. Now, when we say immorality, we talk about, sexual sin and drunkenness and gambling and those kinds of things. But I want to talk a little bit about something different with regard to what is immoral. In Zephaniah chapter 1 and verse 9, we are told, in the same day I will punish all those who leap over the threshold, who fill their master's house with violence and deceit. Now, what does that mean? And it is an interesting phrase, isn't it? Leap over the threshold. What does that mean? We really don't know for sure what it means. There are two possibilities that have been posited in regard to this. One is that they rush headlong into sin. It's like, here they are. They fill their master's house with violence and deceit. They just rush in to wreak havoc. And so violence and deceit is a primary thing. That may very well may be what it is talking about. But I've read a couple of things about this phrase. And it was a phrase that was used and a practice that was present in ancient Philistine culture with regard to their god Dagon. There was an unfortunate happening with regard to Dagon on one particular occasion. He fell, this idol fell into a threshold and was crushed by a door. Broke off the head and broke off the arms and ruined the statue. And because they were a superstitious people, From that point on, the Philistines would never actually step on the threshold. They would always go over the threshold because of their superstition. And so we might be talking about superstition in that specific phrase. I'm not sure if that is the case, but let us use that as an example of immorality. One of the things that is mentioned in the New Testament that is a sin against God is sorcery. And this idea of superstition and magic and all of those kinds of things and the fact that individuals are taken into that. We can't be a superstitious people. We need to understand it. But the other thing, violence and deceitfulness, those are forms of immorality as well. In fact, anything that falls outside of God's moral code is condemned by him and it brings his disapproval. I have here Galatians chapter 5 to read. You know the works of the flesh, which are evident: adultery, fornication, uncleanness, lewdness, idolatry, sorcery, hatred, contentions, and jealousies, outbursts of wrath, selfish ambitions, dissensions, heresies, envy, murders, drunkenness, revelries, and the like. And so those are the types of things we're talking about. They were present in Israel, and they should not have been, and brought God's judgment upon them as a result of it. The next sin we want to make note of is that of materialism. Zephaniah 1 in verse 11. He says, "Well, you inhabitants of Maktesh." Again, the derivation of that name is not certain, but it was most probably a name for a marketplace. And so this here merchants doing business, and you know the greediness that Jesus spoke of with regard to the ones who had made the Lord's house into a den of thieves with the money changers in the temple, those kinds of things. He said, "All the merchant people are cut down and all those who handle money are cut off." And I would say that that's probably one of the most common of all sins. And it is important that money have no large place in our life priorities. Can we say that? I mean, the reason why we work is to make a living. What we want for our children is to have more than what we had when we were growing up. Financial stability is important to us, and we have insurances, and we've got investments and all of these kinds of things. And that's all well and good, but to worry about those things or to be overly interested in those things where they become one of your high priorities in life is something that is not acceptable to God. It shows a lack of trust in him, and it shows, again, a willingness to possibly get caught up into sin, willingness to entertain certain things that may lead to problems. The love of money, Paul said, is the root of all kinds of evil, and some have strayed from their faith in their greediness and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. And so that desire for riches, that putting riches first, there have been men that I have talked to. I'll tell you something, the ones who are very well off that I have come across, that I've had an opportunity to talk to personally in this congregation and other places throughout the years that I've been preaching, is what they'll tell me, and it's dependent upon whether or not they handle it right, when they'll say, "Well, my riches have always been a blessing. I've always been able to help people, and we've done this, and we've done that, and I'm helping my children," all those kinds of things. And there have been a few that have been that way, but there are other men that I've talked to who said, "If I had to do it all again, I would do it all over. I spent so much time in building my business. I spent so much time in emphasizing money, and all. None of my children are faithful. They've all left. Some of them never obeyed the gospel, or they never stayed faithful in those kinds of things because they put the priorities in the wrong place." But then there's the other side of it, isn't there? The love of money can be hit by one who is a poor. For sure. So it's not just the rich we're talking about. In fact, you'll remember in Matthew chapter 6, the warning that Jesus gave not to worry about what you'll eat or what you'll drink or what you'll wear. It's the Gentiles who seek after these things, but if you seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, all these things will be added to you. So materialism, problem in our day as it was in Judah at that particular time. And then the next one is complacency. I love this idea because I think it's another real problem in the church today. Complacency, we're told in Zephaniah 1 and verse 12, notice, "It shall come to pass at that time that I will search Jerusalem with lamps, and I will punish the men who are settled in complacency. You can't misunderstand that, can't you? It says it straight out. They say in their heart, the Lord will not do good nor evil. Okay, so complacency. What it is, okay, I'm living my life day by day, and it sometimes kind of gets hard, so there may be things that get in the way of my coming to worship or my studying the Bible or my prayers that I offer up to God because it's a busy day, something else is happening, but nothing's going to come of it. I mean, I've been alive on this earth for 63 years and nothing has happened. It's just as it always has been. The Lord's not going to punish me or the Lord's not going to do good or anything like that. People have that idea. But that's not true, is it? And so that idea of complacency, men who disregard God and the urgent importance of our service to Him, it's of course in the world, but it can be in and among Christians as well. We even have examples of that. You remember in Revelation chapter 3 when the Lord wrote one of His letters to the church of Laodicea there in Asia, one of the seven churches of Asia. He said, I know your works. You are neither cold nor hot. I don't know if I could ever drink hot milk. I know that that's something a lot of people do drink. They heap milk up in a pot and drink it warm. And there's, of course, cold milk, which I love. I really like that. But have you ever drinking just milk that's been sitting on the counter for a couple hours and it's just lukewarm? It's really not too palatable. It certainly isn't palatable to God for us to have that complacency. He said, because you're lukewarm and neither cold nor hot, I will vomit you out of my mouth. You say I'm rich. You say I'm wealthy and you don't need anything. But you do not know that you are wretched and miserable and poor and blind and naked. Let me tell you something. For a child of God, zeal has to be an aspect of your relationship with the Lord. You need to wake up every day and ask yourself the question, am I zealous for the Lord? Paul certainly did, but you need to ask that every day. If there is anything lacking with regard to your zeal, you need to get it right because it is extremely unpalatable to God for you to be lukewarm. That is not acceptable to Him. Then that gets us to the second of the last list in the list, and that is pride. We're told in Zephaniah chapter 2 about the arrogance of Moab and Ammon. This is an interesting part of our study. We are told this they shall have for their pride because they have reproached and made arrogant threats against the people of the Lord of hosts. So he's indicating with regard to Moab and Ammon, rival nations who sought to harm Israel, that by exalting themselves against Israel and against God, that pride and arrogance was going to bring them down in their destruction. Let me give you an example with regard to a Moabite stone. You've heard about the Moabite stone? In that there is an inscription given concerning a biblical character. He is Misha, the king of the Moabites. He is referenced in 2 Kings chapter 3 and verses 4 and 5. Misha, the king of Moab, was a sheep breeder. Said he regularly paid the king of Israel 100,000 lambs, but when Ahab died, the king of Moab rebelled against the king of Israel. And so they sometimes were subservient, but they never were happy with where they were in the relationship with Israel or Judah. On that inscription that it is found on the Moabite stone, Misha calls himself or is referred to as the son of Chemosh. Now, who is Chemosh? Well, that's the Moabite god. Now, does that sound familiar? The son of Chemosh, the son of God, is what he was saying. So he was an arrogant sort, a God who attributes to himself divinity. I am the son of God. And of course, that's what Jesus claimed as well. Well, what's the difference? Well, Jesus really was the son of God. John 10 and verse 25, Jesus answered him, said, I told you, you don't believe. The works that I do in my Father's name, they bear witness. I am the Son of God. But the Jews answered him in verse 33 and said, for a good work we don't stone you, but for blasphemy, because you being a man make yourself God. I and my Father are one. Me, Misha, I am the son of Chemosh. You can see just the arrogance and the pride that is there. So just like Herod Agrippa, you remember, we are told when individuals came and petitioned Herod Agrippa, the people kept shouting, "The voice of a God and not of a man." And because Herod did not give glory to God, we are told he was eaten by worms and died. We're told the Lord struck him because of his pride and because of his arrogance. Pride is always a problem for man. Pride goes before destruction, before a haughty spirit, before a fall. We need to remember that from Proverbs 16 and verse 18. And that gets us to our final point, and then we just got a couple other things we want to add. But our final sin is oppression. You know, this really always bothers me, because when I see, for example, in the politics of our day and the disparate positions that are found between the Democrat Party and the Republican Party and the arguments that they make. I've always presented myself as a Republican, though I'm not there anymore, I would say that. But it's always my idea, those Democrats, I can't be in good conscience one who is a Democrat because of the immorality that is present, the champion of homosexual rights, the champion of abortion and other kinds of things. But it is an interesting thing when you have the discussion in politics. When you talk about morality, the right will say to the left, "You guys are immoral, and you support immorality." And the left will say to the right, "You guys are immoral, you support immorality." Why? Because you don't care about the poor. Because you don't help people. Because you don't care about people. You're willing to mistreat people. And when you have the socialists that are going against the capitalists, that's the same kind of thing. You want power, yeah, but you don't. You want money, and you're not willing to help anybody, and you want it all for yourself. And all of those arguments are given. And I tell you something, there's some validity to it, because there are an awful lot of people who they are just that way. They oppress the poor, and they oppress the vulnerable. And they ought to be ashamed of that kind of thing, because that is something that is immoral. Let us note Zephaniah 3 and verses 3 and 4, talking here about the leaders of Judah. "Her princes in her midst are roaring lions. Her judges are evening wolves that leave not a bone till morning. Her prophets are insolent. They're treacherous people. Her priests have polluted the sanctuary. They have done violence to the law." In chapter 2 and verse 8, concerning the reproach of Moab and the insults of the people of Ammon, "They have reproached my people," God says. "They have made arrogance a threat against the borders of my people." And that's something we need to know as well, that oppression can come both from within and without. It's easy to what was it, you point one finger but you got three pointing back at you, or something like that. You have to keep that in mind, because it can happen not only outside of the Lord's church, but also inside the Lord's church. God's people have always had evil leaders from time to time. You'll remember from 2 weeks ago when we talked about the elders of Ephesus in Miletus, Paul's admonition, there will be savage wolves that will rise up among you. 3 John in verses 9 and 10, you have Diotrephes who sought the preeminence among them, and he prated with malicious words, and he threw people out of the church, especially those who were supporting someone he considered a rival. "We're not going to have anything to do with those apostles, and I tell you, if you bring an apostle in, I'm going to throw you out too." That's what Diotrephes was saying, because he loved to have the preeminence. So outwardly, power, position, money, they corrupt men. James chapter 2, you remember when there was favoritism being showed toward the rich. James said, "Why are you doing this, brethren? Why would you give preference to a rich man instead of a poor man? Do not the rich oppress you, and they drag you into the courts and blaspheme that noble name by which you were called?" So that can happen within. It also can happen like that without. But understand this, condemnation comes explicitly for those who mistreat God's people. You remember the second letter Paul wrote to the Thessalonians in the first chapter in verse 6. When it talks about God's judgment upon the evil, he said, "It is a righteous thing with God to repay with tribulation those who trouble you with everlasting destruction from the presence of the Lord," as verse 9 says. And that's the end of those who engage in these kinds of sins. So you see why God was not too pleased with Judah at this point in time. But can you not see by our explanation of these things and an examination of them that we're guilty of much of the same in our society today, and perhaps even pervading God's people from time to time, and we need to be careful of them. So as we draw our lesson to a close, I want you to note finally God's judgment. That's what the book is about. The prophecy of Zephaniah is saying, hey guys, this is what you've done. This is why it's coming. And it is going to be awesome. Awesome. Well, understand what we mean by awesome there when we say his judgment is awesome. That's one of the recognitions that we find concerning that judgment. Zephaniah chapter 2 and verse 11. The Lord will be awesome to them. Why? Because he will reduce to nothing all of the gods of the earth. People shall worship him, each from his place, and eat all the shores of the nations. You remember the account that Paul had on Mars Hill in Acts chapter 17? It is God, the God that you don't know, he's the one that has made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on the face of the earth. It is he who has determined their pre-appointed times and the boundaries of their habitations. And the reason he does it, so they should seek him. That's our whole purpose, is to seek God. And I'll tell you something. The demonstration, the divine demonstration of God in that final day of judgment that we have to look forward to will be awesome indeed. Not awesome as in the way it's used today in our nomenclature. Well, that was awesome. No. The awe that we will feel, the fear that we will feel, the reverence that we will feel when God comes in that final day, the day in which the heavens and the earth will be destroyed, the day where every knee will bow before the Son of God, and judgment will be given upon all of the nations. Those who are on the right hand entering into the life, but those on the left hand into everlasting destruction prepared for the devil and his angels. That is truly awesome. But when we talk about the awesomeness of God, what this means is that no one, not even the mighty, no matter how mighty that might be, they cannot stand before him. In fact, in the description in chapter 2 and verse 9, he talked about Moab and said, Moab's going to be like Sodom, and the people of Ammon like Gomorrah. Like Sodom and Gomorrah. Against the nation of Assyria, God had used in judgment. I mean, Assyria, when Josiah is in, so Assyria is still the big bad guy. The Babylonians actually gathered together with others and destroyed Assyria. But at this point in time, Assyria was God's judgment. God brought the children of Israel into captivity through the Assyrians. But now, because Assyria was evil, Zephaniah chapter 2 and verse 15, this is the rejoicing city that dwelt securely, it said in her heart, I am it. That's what Assyria was saying. I am it, there is none besides me. It says, how she has become a desolation, a place for beasts to lie down. Everyone who passes by her shall hiss and shake his fist. Assyria was brought low by the awesome God of heaven. We need to understand the judgment that comes upon those who do not do his will. Now, let's make it personal. That's what I'm asking you to do. We find example after example in the Old Testament of days of judgment coming upon Israel. They suffered greatly. The nations round about and the evil that they did all suffered because God had had enough. Well, that can happen in our society too in some day of judgment or day of the Lord that comes upon our nation, because the rise and fall of our nation is determined by God if he does indeed tarry because of his long suffering. But ultimately, what we have to understand is that each and every individual, each and every one of us, will be judged by the things that we have done in the body, whether good or bad. And the awesome God is the one who is judging us by his revealed will. And that gives us, number one, what it is that we need to do. And number two, perhaps a little bit of motivation to get it right because of who God is and because of the judgment that will come upon us. So it's an Old Testament book. It's not a very long book, but there is a lot that we can learn from it. God always has, and he always will, demand righteousness and service. His will must always be done. And so as we offer an invitation this day, appreciate your kind attention. If there is anyone who desires to do his will today that is not right with him, or if there is any other thing that you need by way of responding to an invitation call, we want you to feel welcome to do that today, and we ask that you come now while together we stand and while we sing.